of the Newsbreaker line. On it is Avi Davis. Mr. Davis is the president of the American Freedom Alliance. He's also the editor of the Intermediate Zone. You may have read one of his columns over the years in the Philadelphia Inquirer. If you visit the American Thinker almost every day, as I do, you've seen his byline and read his columns there very often. And he's with us right now. Mr. Davis, good evening. Thank you. I appreciate you being with us tonight.
Oh, Phil, that's very nice. Very nice to be with you.
I saw the snippet rundown of the conference that you held in Los Angeles Sunday night into Monday morning, and it said, among other things, the goal is to examine the origins of representative government. Am I wrong, or is the Magna Carta really the origin of representative government?
Well, it's hard to say that's the absolute origin. You know, the Anglo-Saxons who inhabited the island of England from about the 5th century onward always had maintained a tradition of representation before their leader or before their king. The king really was the first amongst equals. And many of the rights which later became codified in the Magna Carta were actual rights that has accrued to Anglo-Saxon men in the previous 8 centuries. So it's not, I don't think it's correct to say representative government began with the Magna Carta, but our tradition of representative government, whereby the law is the king is, or the monarch is subservient to the law. The law stands above the king. That certainly was gained a significant boost by the Magna Carta. It was the first time that that the British subjects, even though they were a very narrow band of subjects, rose against monarchical authority and demanded their rights in a contractual form. So it was a very, very important event in Western history, and we can trace the development of these rights, including representative government, from the Magna Carta right through to the promulgation and passage of the U.S. Constitution in 1788.
Yeah.
And then we had benchmarks along the way.
Yeah, I believe that our founding fathers had made it very evident, I guess, that that their inspiration for the Constitution did indeed come from the Magna Carta. That leads me to my second question, and maybe I'm wrong about this as well, but I take it, my understanding is that the Magna Carta, which, by the way, turned 800 years old on Monday, is the first instance of what we might call limited government, in that it tried to limit some of the powers the king had. Is that correct?
That's absolutely true. That is an absolutely true statement. The Norman kings who had conquered England and the first several generations were basically absolute monarchs without any need for conciliar dialogue with their subjects. And the Magna Carta was a statement of the demand of the Norman barons that the king listen to their demands and listen to their needs and respond to the law and rather than to his own whims. This is very, very revolutionary.
Because I know that, for example, if you look in other parts of Europe, I'm thinking of France, as a matter of fact, where probably until the French Revolution, a succession of kings did, in fact, do whatever their whim happened to tell them to do at any given time, including building several garish castles, many of which still stand.
Well, you know, continental Europe is a very it's very interesting to contrast continental Europe with the way that England developed, particularly after the passage of the Magna Carta. because the continental system really did enshrine authoritarian government or absolute monarchy mm-hmm. as the supreme form of governance. And frankly, the French did go through a revolution, but within a very short period of time, fell back into authoritarianism. Then developed a constitutional monarchy that fell apart and then relapsed again into authoritarianism. And then again in the 1940s with Vichy France and over and over. The French don't have the same tradition as the Anglo-Saxons. We were joking at the conference, actually, that, you know, English became the lingua franca because it contained the seeds of freedom. It became the universal language because it contained the actual language, embodied words and words of freedom that French didn't have, which is one of the reasons that English became far more popular. And the French, even though lingua franca is a Latin word and it means the language of the Franks, you know, that was going to be the universal language, but it was actually the triumph of English is a remarkable triumph of what I regard as freedom over authoritarianism.
Hmm. I saw on Monday, NPR had a story online, and it made reference to King John contacting, I don't remember what the Pope's name was at the time, I don't know if it was Pope Pius the First or whatever, saying he was in effect forced to sign, quote unquote, this awful thing. What happened there?
Well, the Pope and the King were at loggerheads, and John had gone up against the Pope without really having any means to. And the Pope was extremely powerful. He was the wealthiest man in England, so to speak, because he controlled all of these churches, which had enormous. The monasteries had enormous wealth, and they had influence. And John actually came to terms with the Pope eventually and installed an archbishop by the name of Stephen Langton. And Langton was the one who led the barons against, it is believed, led the barons against King John, demanding their rights. And really, the Pope was very much behind it at the time. And then Langton is believed even to have authored the Magna Carta. He actually wrote the document.
Ah.
Although we really don't know. So the Pope and King John, and this is, you know, it was a very complicated period of history where the Pope and King John and the English monarchy were at loggerheads for control over England. And King John basically gave in and then found himself with a document he couldn't live with. So he repudiated it, but died before the civil war, which then ensued, could remove him from power. But his son, Henry III, was 9 years old and took office in 1216, ascended the throne in 1216. Basically adopted the Magna Carta immediately, reissued it. It was reissued in 1217, reissued in 1225, and reissued about 40 times until the English Civil War in the 1640s.
So because that was where I was going next. My next question, because the Magna Carta was supposedly in, and you just explained how that happened, was in vogue, in power for a short period of time, but then reinstituted several years later under John's son Henry. So it wasn't written to be a permanent document, but became a permanent document as a result of the English Civil War. Is that correct?
Well, I wouldn't say that. It did become a permanent document. It became a fixture of English law by the end of the 13th century, under the reign of Edward I. It became ingrained in English common law. So it was certainly, but it wasn't its heyday. I should say that Magna Carta, you know, tyrannical kings, you know, Henry VIII, for instance, and you know, a few of his successors, the Stuarts in the 1600s, were people who believed in the divine right of kings.
Mm-hmm.
So Magna Carta really gained its most significant problems and was drawn on significantly by the Roundheads in the English Civil War in the 1640s, and it resulted, of course, in the execution of Charles II, Charles I, and thereafter, the forced abdication of his son James II in the 1680s, and the onset of what we call today the Glorious Revolution, which established constitutional monarchy in England.
This may sound like a dumb question, but I'm forced to ask it anyway. Have you seen the actual document? And the reason I ask that is it long? I understand there are 63 clauses to it. Yeah, how many pages is it? You know, the basic physical structure of it.
Well, it's actually just a scroll with a seal attached to it. Four copies of the original Magna Carta survived, and I did see it. I saw it in Canberra several years ago. It's in the House of Representatives in Canberra, in Australia, where I'm originally from. Mm-hmm. So I had the privilege of seeing it, and it's a remarkable thing to see, not only because of its antiquity, but because it is. It wasn't written in clauses. It's not pages. It's just one scroll.
Okay.
And what we would call run-on sentences. You know, it's not well organized. So you can't see, you know, clause by clause. The clauses are almost arbitrary. And some translations of it have it at 73 clauses.
Okay.
Some of them have it at 64, some of them 63. So it's not, you know, not a hard and fast rule, you know, what it is, but you can actually see it. I think there's a copy of it in the United States, although I'm not entirely sure. There are at least two copies in England today, and I think they were on display at Runnymede on Monday.
Is it written in Old English, what we now call Old English?
No, it's written in Latin.
It's written in Latin?
Yes.
I'll bet a lot of people don't know that, including me. I was not aware of that. I had always assumed that it was written in what we referred to as Old English. Is it impossible to overstate its importance? I mean, we just made reference to the United States Constitution that was obviously found, the framers of it found their inspiration in the Magna Carta. Is this perhaps, and I don't know, maybe this is off base and maybe it sounds an amateurish way to put it, but I'm going to phrase it this way anyway. Is this perhaps the founding document, the most important document that still survives today that led to the various forms of representative government around the world right now?
Yes. The simple answer is yes. I don't think you can overstate the importance of the Magna Carta. Although there are significant attempts to do that in the professoriate, in academia, amongst the many historians, revisionist historians, who just poo-poo the whole thing and just think it was a backroom deal mm-hmm. between King John and his cronies that he repudiated anyway, almost immediately. I don't buy into that. I think the Magna Carta stands as a significant, one of the most significant documents in human history, and changed the world in many ways because it was adopted. You see, English and the English peoples dominated the world and still dominate it. Dominate today. The language of the internet, which links the entire world, is English and will be for the foreseeable future. Mm-hmm. I can't see any change in that. And you will not be able to do business internationally if you don't know English. It'll become an absolute requirement. And as I said, the English language carries in its vocabulary the words of freedom and the concepts of freedom. And it's one of the reasons today that we have human rights, because it became defined in English. And It's a wonderful thing, you know, to read a book by Daniel Hannan, the Member of Parliament for Southwest England in the European Union. He's written a book called Inventing Freedom, which I recommend to all of your listeners. Really a wonderful celebration of the miracle of the English people's development and the spread of their concepts of liberty and freedom. And that's what we celebrate today. We'll celebrate it on the 15th at our conference, and that's what the questions we address. We address the Anglosphere and how all of these countries, including the United States, England, Scotland, Ireland,
Canada,
Australia, New Zealand, Canada, all of us are linked together, and will lead the world, I believe, into the 21st century.
You made reference to this about revisionists to historians. There was a guy who claimed to be a historian who was getting some attention in New York several years ago by the name of Leonard Jeffries, who totally disavowed the Magna Carta and referred to it as a backroom deal and nothing all that important, as you made reference to. We live in a very different world, Mr. Davis, than we did as recently as 25 or 30 years ago. Have you run into pockets, conferences, groups of people who think it is politically incorrect to celebrate anything that has English European origins, including the Magna Carta, despite its importance?
Well, of course I do, all the time. You know, these are the documents of dead white males, just like the literature
that's
of Shakespeare.
That's what I was getting to, exactly.
Just like the literature of Shakespeare. You know, this is stuff that, you know, this is the language of oppression. You know, this is, you have to understand, L.A., that today so many of our historians and academics view history through the lens of sex, of gender, race, class, or sexual orientation, and I should add colonialism or imperialism.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are the fundamental lenses and prisms through which to view history, and it's a significant denial. It leads to a significant denial of what is essentially a glorious history. Yes, there are slavery, and there are terrible things that happened too, the Crusades. But, you know, you have to take the good with the bad, unfortunately, when you're studying history. And the end result is that we have reached a period of time, after 800 years of struggle, we've reached a period in time where a vast percentage of the of humankind is free and lives with the liberties envisaged by the Magna Carta. And I think that is something worth celebrating, and I think it's something worth venerating. And I'm incensed when I hear historians dismiss the Magna Carta or frankly, the U.S. Constitution. Mm-hmm. As somehow mediocre documents that don't deserve the attention we give them.
Well, I don't know if you saw, I guess it's relatively recently, it's about 2 years ago, that one of our own Supreme Court justices, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, went to, I believe it was South Africa or another country that was in the process of writing a constitution, and said, if you're looking for constitutions to emulate, maybe you should pick somebody else's other than the United States. I was incensed by that.
Well, you know, it's part of the guilt trip through which so many progressives seem to trip, you know, or pass. They really do not appreciate what we have. They are filled with guilt for, you know, slavery, for the imposition of white rule, for just being successful, for capitalism, for wealth, you know, this for power that has accrued to us but there's never been as benign a power as the United States of America in world history.
Mm-hmm.
Never. Never has there been a country as rich as the richest country in the history of the world, as rich as America, which hasn't sought to conquer the rest of the world. Although the progressives would say we did attempt to conquer the rest of the world. you know, and it's unfortunate and it's tragic that so many people like Ruth Bader Ginsburg and a few other justices on the Supreme Court and our leaders like Nancy Pelosi and others aren't able to express this admiration for their country that has given them and their children and will give their grandchildren the liberties that most people throughout history never had.
Mr. Davis, I have to do this, but can I ask you to hold on through a commercial break? I have a few additional questions. I also have a listener who wants to ask you a question, and I know the guy, so I know he's going to be respectful. Would that be okay?
Yes. All right.
We're speaking with Avi Davis. Mr. Davis is the president of the American Freedom Alliance, who held a conference Saturday night into Sunday celebrating the 800th birthday of the Magna Carta. All right, 7:31, running a little late. Our guest tonight is Avi Davis. Mr. Davis is the president of the American Freedom Alliance, also primarily in charge of a conference over the weekend in Los Angeles that celebrated the 800th anniversary of the Magna Carta. I'm a steady caller, Duke from Dallas, who has a question about a copy of the Magna Carta. Duke, you're on WIOK with Avi Davis.
Yeah, good evening, gentlemen. It's interesting that in the Divine Right of Kings, John Locke as Thomas Jefferson, you know, more or less put into the Declaration of Independence that, you know, we're on our own and the right of the people is from those who are governing. And I find it fascinating that Ben Franklin managed to convince a monarchy, an oppressive monarchy, to support another revolution against a rival monarchy. But my big question here is, if you go down to Washington, D.C., to the National Archives, they have one of the copies of the Declaration of Independence, they have a copy of the Constitution, and they also have a copy of the Magna Carta. And I'd like to ask you, are you familiar with that copy? I heard that you said that there are several copies, four, and you weren't sure where they were, and you thought two were in the United States. I have seen the one in the National Archives, and I'd be curious to hear what you know about that.
Well, I do know there's one in the National Archives, and actually one of the speakers at our conference addressed with a reference to the fact that he'd stood in front of these documents and was just baffled by them because he knew the significance of them. He's an attorney himself and an academic, a legal academic. And he said that he saw these and was absolutely stunned by them and felt that, you know, he was standing in the presence of something sacred. So, yes, there is one that I know of in the United States. There's probably not another. There was, during the Second World War, it was on display, I think, in New York, and tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people, I think millions, actually crammed into a museum there, or maybe it was on Capitol Hill, I don't know. But millions went to see it, to view it. And then the Second World War broke out, and that copy was scurried away to Fort Knox and held at Fort Knox for safekeeping during the course of hostilities. And then return to England.
That was the one question I was going to ask you. During World War II, were any of the copies lost to German bombing or anything?
Well, there are many copies of the Magna Carta. We're talking really about the original.
Yes, right.
12:15. But there are many copies from 12:17, 12:25, 12:65, you know, on and on. The Magna Carta was reissued. So, I'm not sure about the other copies, but I know that the four copies, the extant copies, were protected and did not suffer destruction during that time.
When the Magna Carta was reissued those years that you mentioned, was it in the exact same form, or were there revisions the way that the American Constitution has been amended over the years?
Well, there was substantially amended. There were many things that were taken out. In fact, you know, the Magna Carta that came down through the centuries barely bore a resemblance to the original
document.
Wow. It retained very few things. But the basic ideas about the check on arbitrary power was very much a part of every Magna Carta. And that these were rights. The rights became increasingly refined and articulated over the course of the centuries. So Magna Carta was an evolving document. Many people say we need one now. We need a Magna Carta of our own. We need it reissued. We certainly need to reissue the spirit of it, because you can get very used to, as I've seen, just in the last 8 years, I've become very, you become habituated to the abuse of executive power in the White House. And I think that more than anything, the Magna Carta becomes extremely relevant when progressives start to argue that more and more power should be reserved for the central government at the expense of our individual rights. And so Magna Carta is extremely relevant today, and it's maybe why progressives argue that it has no relevance.
Right. Right. Well, as a matter of fact, when we were just discussing Justice Ginsburg's comments years ago, I think the primary reason she said what she said is because the American Constitution, looking to the Magna Carta, limited the power of government, and there are many who would like the government to have essentially not unlimited power.
Right. Yes. There are people who want that, and that's authoritarianism. That's returning us to the days of bad King John. And who wants that? Who wants their freedoms and liberties? And who, amongst us who treasure those things, who wants them looted in that way? Maybe if you're living in an Islamic republic, you won't mind it that much.
Well, that's another story. That's another long discussion. Was there ever a time in the Magna Carta's history where British people as a whole looked at it and said, it's nice inspiration, that's where everything came from, but it doesn't really have any practical relevance to what is happening today?
Well, I think I just explained how it has absolute relevance to what's happening today. The check on arbitrary power has to, in every generation, we have to think about that. It's very tempting for leaders to aggregate power and give themselves rights as leaders that the Constitution doesn't allow.
Right.
You know, and the check on it, I mean, the Constitution provides a check, you know, with the separation of powers, provides a check on those powers. But, you know, when the executive office starts to ignore the checks, the legislative and judicial checks on power, we've got a very serious problem. We've got the potential for a usurpation of the republic by individuals who wish to control it.
Well, obviously, we've had several challenges along those lines, and recently a federal court has ruled against one of those executive orders that our current president issued, and he is appealing it. Mr. Davis, I appreciate you being with us for the last 40 minutes or so. Avi Davis is the president of the American Freedom Alliance. He's the editor of the Intermediate Zone. You every once in a while see his columns in the Philadelphia Inquirer, the Chicago Tribune, the Los Angeles Times. If you check any of those papers online, many of us read the Inquirer. And if you look at the website, The American Thinker, which I'm a steady reader of, you see Mr. Davis comments there very often. Thank you very much for being with us tonight.
LA, it's absolutely wonderful to be with you.
Okay, thanks. I hope we can talk again.